Michelle Flournoy of the Center for a New American Security is my guest, and you are speaking recently and have written before about a more cost-conscious culture at the Defense Department. Michelle, I mentioned before we went on the air that I talked to Beth McGrath yesterday, and that is a focus of the strategic management plan for 2014-2015. From your sense of your experience at the Defense Department, what are the critical elements for implementing, installing a cost conscious culture? Because the culture part, of course, is much more than just saying we're going to do it or implementing a policy document.
Well, you know, a lot of it boils down to taking a very close look at the incentive structures that the department has in place for various key people and decision makers. For example, you know, today in the area of acquisition and looking at program managers, today's system essentially penalizes people that don't spend every last dime of their budget before the end of the fiscal year, because if they don't spend the money that's allocated, Congress is likely going to appropriate a smaller amount for their program next year. It's sort of a use it or lose it environment. But, you know, imagine a situation where program managers were evaluated for promotion on whether they could actually meet their program milestones while saving taxpayer dollars. That would be an example of changing an incentive structure to reward people for much more cost-effective ways to manage their programs.
That argument looks good within the microcosm of the individual programs and maybe even broader swaths of the department, but we still have the kind of the wild card of how Congress will ultimately deal with those dollars, and you have to change a culture there too, I suppose. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely. This is going to require a very serious dialogue with members of Congress, because the department repeatedly has made efforts to go in the direction of reform, whether it's, for example, shifting, some of the management of healthcare costs, or trying to end procurement programs that no longer meet military needs. And there are many examples where Congress has said, no, you know, you've got to keep procuring the system even though you don't need it anymore, or no, we're not going to let you make that management reform because of, you know, entrenched or parochial interests. I think what's changed is the fact that we are in a period now of sustained budgetary austerity. We are in an historic defense downturn. And to be able to manage that well and come out the other end with a force that can actually still protect this nation and its interests overseas, we've got to have a very frank conversation with Congress about the need to make some hard choices and be more disciplined, both, you know, not only the department, but members of Congress as well, in terms of what we put in the defense budget.
Let's strategize that incentive structures concept a little bit, Michelle, if we can, please. Is that something that we would start, do you think, from the bottom up, like at the program level, and move it up the chain? Or is that something that starts at the ATL level and goes down? Or how do you kind of walk into that to begin with?
You know, I think there's a lot that can be done top down, but it does take really kind of digging into the details of why organizations behave the way they do. And I'll give you just a personal example from when I was undersecretary. We put a big emphasis on human capital development and training our people. And I went out and said to all the supervisors, you know, it's really important that all of our people get to a certain amount of training every year. Everybody nodded their heads up and down. And then 6 months later, I checked in on how are we doing against that goal and found basically nothing had changed. And what I realized was that, you know, the supervisors were worried about people being away off the job. Could they get the work done without them there? So I finally realized, you know, the way to go at this is to change the incentive and to say, supervisors, you're now going to be evaluated on how well you do in getting your people to training. So you're going to be measured to what percentage of your people you get to training every year. And it was remarkable that simple change of incentive had a huge response in the organization in terms of people getting to getting to the goal of getting people the training they needed. So it does take getting down into the nitty-gritty of what are the incentives that are governing behavior and people's choices about how they make trade-offs. And that requires certainly a dialogue with the folks on the line and helping them operate differently, if that's what you're asking them to do.
Michelle Flournoy is the former Undersecretary of Defense for Policy and now of the Center for a New American Security. You've also spoken recently at the NCMA, the National Contract Management Association Conference, about adopting some private sector techniques for saving money. In the, what are some of those where you think there is potential that the Pentagon could implement them quickly and gain some pretty quick savings?
Well, for example, I think you see many large global companies in the private sector that have sought to become much more efficient in recent years. Some of them have adopted an approach that's called delayering, which is a way of removing unnecessary management layers in an organization and really paying attention to spans of control and basically redesigning the organization from the top down to be much more lean and much more agile with a real focus on performance. And you've seen companies like AT&T go through this on a global basis. Others, typically they see about a 20% overhead reduction in cost savings while also seeing improved performance. Now, in the government sector, there are restrictions, civil service rules, other factors to be taken into account. But I think going through an exercise like that could give the government a better sense of where is, you know, what's the design of the organization ideally that we'd like to migrate to over time as people retire, as we perhaps Congress gives some flexibility to reshape the workforce with some authorities that we've traditionally had during periods of drawdown. You know, where are we trying to go to? I think it's very important to have that sense of, you know, the ideal organization you're trying to get to over time.
You've given a big thumbs up to Secretary Hagel's identification of cutting overhead spending as a place to get some achieve some cost savings or cost avoidance within the department. Secretary Gates had identified the same thing and didn't really make a lot of progress, mostly due to structural issues inside DOD, that just the sheer size that he was dealing with. Do you see the situation changing or see that it has changed in such a way that Secretary Hagel can be successful doing this?
Well, a couple things. One is, I think I applaud the goal that Secretary Hagel set of a 20% staff reduction in headquarters and so forth, but I would like to see the department be even more ambitious. The Department of Defense in 2011, which is the last year for which we have good statistics, spent $212 billion on overhead. That is more than the entire GDP of the state of Israel. It's enormous. We have almost 800,000 civilians in the department, another close to 800,000 contractors supporting the department. This is an area that has experienced tremendous growth during the war years for understandable reasons. But now is a period where we've got to prune back that growth and right-size the organization again. So I think we need to be more ambitious. And I think we need to see the administration needs to ask and receive from Congress some new authorities, whether to reshape the workforce. That's something that's been granted in past periods of drawdown. It's something that Congress needs to step up and provide so that the department has the tools it needs to make the hard choices in the smart way. You know, we can do this smart or we can do it stupid, and their national security hangs in the balance. So, you know, there needs to be a very frank discussion with members of Congress about giving the department the right kind of flexibility to do it smart.
Now, one of the criticisms of shrinking the sizes of the active duty forces and reserves is that if we do need the forces in a crisis at some point in the future, it will be much more difficult to ramp them up, to go out and find all those people or find replacements for those people and get them back into service. Do you think the same argument could be made converse to your position about kind of maintaining the level of civilian workforce that we have now?
Well, again, I think we need to really right-size the force for the mission. And I think the fact that we do have the flexibility of a contract workforce that can either expand or contract to support the department, it provides a certain degree of a hedge. You know, I look at the military force growth that happened during the period of wars. You know, you had this extraordinary circumstance of two large, long ground campaigns at the same time. Not a usual circumstance. But I actually look at what the Army and the Marine Corps that grew so much, what they did, and it's a success story. The fact that we could grow the force with quality at a time of war, and it continued to perform quite well. That's a good news story. So as we draw down the ground forces, we want to make sure that we maintain the mechanisms that give us the flexibility if we find ourselves in that kind of unlikely circumstance again in the future. Similarly, on the civilian side, the fact that we do have flexibility of contracting gives us that agility. But that to me is an argument against maintaining a larger than necessary either military force in being or civilian force in being, because it's an unnecessary expense. The truth is we have mechanisms that give us the flexibility to grow in the future if we need to.
You mentioned that we have a total of about 1.6 million or so people that work in the civilian ranks, either as Pentagon employees or as contractors serving the Pentagon. How do we prevent, how do we do a drawdown and prevent just the badge flipping where maybe we wind up with 30% fewer civilian employees, but that work gets contracted out? I guess what we need to figure out is how the Pentagon does fewer things or does what they're doing now with fewer people.
Yeah, I agree. There are a couple parts to this. One is just a good scrub of the missions and tasks. And in a period of growth, which we've experienced for more than a decade, when money is really not an object, you know, there's a lot of things that get added to the list of to-dos. I think we're in a period where we need to get back to distinguishing between what is absolutely essential, what is very important, versus what is nice to do. And I think there's a lot of scrubbing of just what's essential and what should we stop doing as a department, given the more resource-constrained environment. Secondly, there's a lot that can be done to update how we do things. We are in an information age. IT, information technology, can be a huge efficiency gain if it's applied correctly. My own view is that the department still suffers from a lot of business practices that were very cutting edge when Robert McNamara came from Ford Motor Company in the 1950s, but have become very entrenched, but really don't fully leverage the sort of cutting-edge business practices that you find in the private sector today. So I think there's also a lot that can be done in terms of simplifying our approaches, adopting best business practices from outside, and updating and modernizing how the department gets its work done.
Ma'am, those are all the questions I have for you. I'm very grateful for your time, and I appreciate you doing